Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It's the first day of March, so we've survived 2 months of this, the second year of 2020.
The second year of 2020. Yes, I guess it is, isn't it? But it's okay because everyone tells us we're going to be out of the woods in April.
Not everyone.
Well, right. Many people say.
You're finding things that are saying that to you, but is it possible that you're just going and looking for your bias because you want everything to be over, and so you're finding sources that agree with you, which is a very wicked thing to do.
Right. Yeah.
That's not what you're doing.
No. No, I'm not. I'm talking about like the New York Times opinion piece, and then there's an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal, so they're not shutting up. I mean, there does seem to be a growing sense of turning back to normalcy. So,
I do feel like I did go and watch a clip of Dr. Fauci saying that I'm not against Fauci and I'm not for Fauci either. Like, I'm just prepared to read whatever he says and try to deal with it one way or another. I'm not in the church of Fauci. But I'm also not, like, prepared to write off everything he says. I'm trying to keep an open mind. As with our governor,
I don't know. You know, he when he lost me, it's like, if you put on 5 masks, that's even better than.
I was gonna say, I'm very against our governor.
Yeah.
On account of how he
killed all the people
in the nursing homes, right. But when. The way that the latest little clip that I saw of Dr. Fauci talking about society and what was good for society. So there were going to be certain things that we as individuals could maybe do, but for the sake of society, it was going to be important that we not do a lot of things like have any gatherings. And this is, again, most of the population being vaccinated. Even wearing masks post-vaccination, we should still, for the sake of society, not gather into groups or see our grandparents or whatever. But it wasn't so much what he said. It was his choice of terminology and the manner in which he said it, which was excessively condescending.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen. Like, we're not going to start meeting or start doing things. So that's just not going to happen. And and in fact, when the majority of the people have, I don't want to make this podcast about about.
We actually have something to talk about. We have something to talk about. One last thing here.
And that's it.
Can't.
You know, for all this time, they've been saying, Sweden has been making a bad go of it by just not having the regulations, letting people walk around until they get herd immunity. But now I'm reading, we're just waiting for everyone to get the vaccine. And since we have a lot of people who have had COVID, we're going to be reaching herd immunity very soon. So,
herd immunity had been debunked recently.
Yeah.
And that actually we didn't want herd immunity. There was no such thing. But then now
it's like it's all good again.
It's a thing we can actually have, whereas we couldn't have it
before
last November or whatever.
So I color me suspicious and irritated with our dear leaders.
I mean, I do want to go on record again and say that I don't want anyone to die. Like.
Yes.
I don't want anyone old to die. I don't want to lose our entire older population, which is why I was really, really, really angry with our governor for sending COVID positive people into the most vulnerable places. Like,
yeah, that was a bad thing.
It was a bad thing.
It was a bad choice.
And it's also
a bad choice.
It was also bad that apparently our governor is also being accused of sexual harassment, which I noticed online isn't a big deal because it's not
believe the woman anymore. So
yeah.
Believe the women. That's somehow
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has come out and said, believe the women. And it's the first time I've thought, Okay, I'm going to go in and see what she has to say, because I think, as with everything...
Right, she said, believe the women about Andrew
Cuomo? She did call him out, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
I thought,
I'm surprised.
It's... As with, like, the whole previous 4 years, it's possible to listen to all the people, listen to the women, and if they're believable, if they are, you know, investigate their claims honestly, without just being like, no, you're a woman. I can't believe you. But then if it turns out that they're lying, you don't have to believe them.
Yeah.
But if they aren't lying, maybe you could believe them. I don't know. I guess this is like a really hard thing.
It's crazy talk.
Anyway, we actually have something to talk about today. And yes. I don't want to talk about it because I'm so deeply... I don't know what the nice word is. I have ennui. about this. I'm really tired of talking about it, but we should do it anyway because that's what this podcast is about. So why don't you say, what is it that we're talking about today?
Well, we are going to talk about the Dear Gay Anglicans letter that Peter Bialk, Peter. I don't know. It's P-I-E-T-E-R and then Bialk. And so I don't mean to mispronounce his name, but that's, I don't know how he pronounces it. So he is, I didn't know this, he has been associated with Revoice, and we've talked about Revoice before on this podcast, which is a movement seeking to form a kind of community around those people who are committed to celibacy in their sexual life, but who are also recognize that they have an affection or they're drawn toward people of the same sex. So and Revoice is dedicated to, well, it kind of presents that as in the same terms you might present a minority group, an ethnic minority group, and is trying to create this sense of marginalization and victimization in some ways, because the church is not, they would say dealt with them fairly. And
well, they have to have a way of being faithful inside of the church.
Right.
And they haven't had that before,
they say.
And so they are joining together to have community and support each other in their difficult time. But inside of Revoice is also the spiritual friendship movement, isn't it?
Like, right.
It's not, those two things aren't exactly the same, but they are very close together, which is that if you endure a same-sex attraction, the kinds of friendships that you have are more different than other people's.
Yeah, there's an argument that within that affection, that aspect of yourself, the friendship aspect of that can be redeemed and should be redeemed. And so the spiritual friendship movement was about doing that. And, you know, Wes Hill, who is the president of the spiritual friendship movement. I'm not sure what his title is, but I'll just call him president, has said that men who are homosexual should enter into covenant relationships with one another and say vows of friendship.
Yeah.
And remain celibate, but there's this kind of special, unique
aspect different than heterosexual friendship,
right?
Or two heterosexual men being friends with each other wouldn't really understand the kind of friendship that two same-sex attracted men would have with each other.
And when there's any, yeah.
So I'm going to try to just be really temperate and not say anything.
And so when there's any criticism leveled at these two movements, the immediate response is, well, wait a minute, why are you criticizing us? We have a traditional sexual ethic. We have we are fundamentally agreeing that the affection or the desire to have sexual relationships with people who are of the same sex is a disordered desire. We're not going to engage in those relationships. So why would you critique us? And the response from our side is, well, because, even the, even though if you don't indulge in lust, and even if you don't indulge in any kind of activity to express the sexual desire, it's still a disordered affection. And if you were to you just think about any other kind of disordered affection, but what I mean by disordered affection is it's an affection that flows right out of the fall. You wouldn't have that wouldn't be there if there weren't, if the fall had not taken place. So
you can't say God made me this way.
Yeah. You can't say God made me this. You can say that God in his providence
allowed this to happen
to me, but it's not that the affection itself is not a God created thing. It's the ruination of a God created thing. And we all have that. We all have disordered affections. It's not just them. Everybody has something from the fall that you would like to do that you can't do. And the thing is, though, those are things that we should always be repenting of. Those are these disordered affections. And you might, if you're Roman Catholic, you might know the term concupiscence. The Protestant Reformed position is that concupiscence itself, even if it's not indulged in, is something that we recognize points to our utter fallenness. And so we confess these things as sin, and we don't like form communities around them. Or
we don't
identify with them.
We don't say that they're special and God-given.
There's nothing to be redeemed. Like, so for example, in this case, if in fact two men can, who have this disordered affection, are able to form a good, solid friendship, that's not a unique thing about the disordered affection. That's just friendship. You haven't redeemed any aspect of the fallen order. It's disorder. It's only, you're just being friends. So there's no real room for a movement of gay Anglicans or gay Christians doing this, gathering around their disordered affection. Just call yourself, you're just friends. And you've got to be careful because, you know,
actually, your friendship is more fraught than it would be if you didn't have that disordered affection.
It's not deeper; it's more dangerous. And the same thing, you know, I'm a heterosexual male, and if I were to try and form a deep, rich friendship that involved the taking and giving of vows with a woman outside my marriage, that would be a dangerous thing, and it would be an unwise thing for me to do.
Well, it would be a dangerous thing because I would come and find you and hunt you down. Right.
Oh, but we're just friends. This is a spiritual friendship, sweetie.
And I would, I wouldn't respond well. You wouldn't think of me as a paragon of rational virtue, but actually the deep anger that I would feel at that would be appropriate and right.
So, Just to give the theological perspective on this, and before we move into the letter that Peter Valk wrote, Dr. Ashley Noel, who is he's probably recognized as the world class expert on Thomas Cranmer, who's the reformer, the Anglican reformer, and our understanding of Cranmer's theology in the articles.
Peter Valk intimated on Twitter that the articles were written in such a way that they allowed a wide range of interpretive meaning, and that the meaning of that can be deconstructed according to the time and the place that we find ourselves, which is an incredibly specious claim, mm-hmm. which Ashley Noel here puts to rest, doesn't he?
So, right. So the reason Peter Valk said that is because in response to his letter, which we haven't read yet, I was pointing out that Article 9 of our 39 articles recognizes that concupiscence is a sin. Itself, it's something that we should be confessing as sin. And Peter Falk came on and said, well, the 39 articles are so, they were like a political document. It's so, who can understand what they mean, because they were so nuanced and difficult and just impossible for us to grasp. And so in response to that, I mean, direct response to that, Ashley Noel commented on a friend of ours' Facebook page. And let me just read the comment, because I think it's really, really helpful in kind of framing this. the nature of concupiscence was at the very heart of the Reformation dispute. Essentially, the Roman position was that concupiscence is not sin without an intention to act upon it, the position which Volk has suggested. This understanding of concupiscence was necessary for medieval Romans in order to defend the notion that human beings could ever have personal righteousness worthy of salvation. Luther's insight was that the concupiscence can move us in sinful ways that we are not conscious of. In essence, a recognition of the power of the subconscious to move us in fallen, self-centered, self-protecting ways. And therefore it, quote, hath of itself the nature of sin, as Article 9 puts it. That's why justification by faith was necessary in the view of the Protestants. The Bible taught salvation was by faith because humanity had no other option. In the 16th century, that last clause of Article 9 was a clear, unambiguous denial of Roman soteriology in favor of the Protestant position. So, this Dr. Ashley Knoll, I think, clearly understands what's happening here in this movement and recognizes also the theological dangers of it. We are talking about an understanding of anthropology, of the human person, that finds kind of righteousness within, goodness within. And while we all say that we are made in God's image, I think the biblical and certainly the Reformed view is that image has been shattered so much that we don't look for goodness within. We look for...
It has to be pieced together again, right, from outside.
Right. Okay. So should we read the...
I think so. Okay, but why are we reading this letter now? Because it's been out for a week and it's been written about on every... I mean, I've written about it. Everyone's written about this letter and it was taken down. So why are we going back and reading the letter now again? Well, I think because no one actually read the letter on air.
Well, it got taken down, for one. I mean, thankfully, our bishops have asked that Peter Gall, well, his bishop told him to take it down.
And I was offended by the way that it was taken down, which was, I'm going to take it down, but I'm going to reiterate what was inside the letter,
right,
while I take it down, and I'm going to still victimize myself instead of just straight out obeying and saying, yes, sir, taking it down quietly. Not speaking of it ever again, but anyway, go on.
But also because just this morning, I'm sure it's published, I'm not sure exactly when it's published, but Andrew Goddard of the Church of England, who's a conservative, an Orthodox guy, but takes, in the English conservative or English Orthodox clergy within the CV have a very... I would say, and I'm not trying, how can I say this in a nice way?
You're going to say something you shouldn't say.
Milquetoast.
Oh, my kid, that's not the nice thing. That's not helpful.
Weak sauce.
No. Just stop.
Less than robust.
Okay. I mean,
way of defending orthodoxy.
I think that they...
That this was published in Fulcrum is all that should be need to be said. If anyone is listening who remembers the Anglican Wars, you know what role Fulcrum played, which was one of...
Quietly undermining everything.
Everything Orthodox and compromising, right. So it wasn't originally published at Fulcrum, but Fulcrum is now...
Picked it up.
Or maybe it was. I'm not sure. We're going to read some more. Anyway, so I want to revisit that letter, because Andrew Goddard was just full of praise for it, and he's angry at the not angry he critiqued the ACNA bishop's statement about it, which the bishop's statement said you shouldn't identify as gay, as a gay Christian or a gay Anglican, or I'm sorry, a gay Christian. And so the debate's going on, and I think we should readdress the letter. But
okay, go ahead. And so the long day wears on. The long Anglican day and the long Anglican night.
Well, now you made me lose it, so I gotta go back and find it.
I tried to read the Andrew Goddard, and all I could think of was that in Emma by Jane Austen, it's Mrs. Goddard whose home for young women is where Harriet lives.
And, oh,
So then I thought when I clicked on the letter, this is going to be so great because I was thinking of Jane Austen. And then as I began to read the letter, I was more and more disappointed until I got to the end and thought,
"This isn't
I'm
Jane
so
Austen.
Deeply bored right now. I just want to die." So it's hard for me to care, but I'm trying my best. Did you find it?
Yes. Okay. So I'll come to the preamble. This is, it's found since he took it down, it can only be found in full right now on Anglican Ink, and I linked it at Stand Firm. If you go to the statement that we put up for people to sign, you can find it linked there. So let me go ahead and...
Are you reading it?
Yeah. The College of Bishops of the Anglican Church in North America recently spoke about sexuality or sexual identity, and invited Anglicans to discern these matters within their own diocesan communities and ministries. He quotes that, to discern these matters within their own diocesan communities and ministries. ACNA bishops have privately provided pastoral guidance to local churches, with at least one bishop offering guidance to his clergy that can be read publicly. He's referring there to Bishop Todd Hunter, who came out right after the statement that he himself gave assent to, and essentially undermined everything the statement said. So in fact, he used the terminology gay Christian throughout his statement. And I know a number of people, a number of bishops were upset with Todd Hunter for this. ACNA bishops have privately provided pastoral guidance to local churches, with at least one bishop offering guidance to his clergy that can be read publicly. To continue this public discernment, the ACNA bishops, priests, deacons, and lay people who have signed below humbly offer this letter of confession and commitment to gay Anglicans, with an unwavering commitment to the authority, mission, and community of the ACNA. There are three things there.
Okay, yeah. No, you can't just say something. You can't just be like, saying something doesn't make it so. Like saying, I have an unwavering commitment to the ACNA, but now I'm going to go and contradict everything that the bishops of the ACNA have said. And also dig at the reason for why, you know, one of the founding reasons for the ACNA was that the tech fell into an error, a presenting error of homosexuality, but the deeper error is one of scriptural authority, mm-hmm. of anthropology, of right. Like it goes all the way to the depths of your Christian faith when right. you think about this issue. But whatever, just say, I have unwavering support for whatever organization, even while I'm like literally contradicting what right. it says.
It's interesting because you know in the paragraph he said, you expect when someone says we humbly offer this letter of confession, you expect that what they're going to do is confess their own sins, right? But it actually is going to be a confession of the ACNA's sin against them.
Yeah, so which is again a very tech move. Like
right.
In tech, we were always invited to confess the sins that others committed on our behalf. Right. So when you had like
we confess that.
We've misused the earth because oil companies spilled oil in the right. ocean. And like, even though I was on land and I had never bought oil from that company and I wasn't on a boat, I know nothing about seafaring. I need to confess the sins of that guy.
We confess that President Bush is a racist.
Yeah. You're like,
no.
Okay, but I'm not President Bush, so his racism is something. But
it was a really way of politically posturing to say to
it was like that. early version virtue signaling.
Right. So here's this, and they're going to confess that they've been sinned against instead of, and so what really this should say, if it wasn't a deceptive letter, and there is actual deceit throughout this letter, because he suggested that he had vetted this letter through the province, and the archbishop came out and said, no, you didn't. That never happened.
If a text message 30 seconds before you put it up online is vetting
yeah.
through the province, then yeah. sure.
Right. So so it should read, the ACNA bishops, priests, deacons, and lay people who have signed below humbly offer this letter of accusation.
Yeah.
instead of confession.
And by humbly, we mean
arrogantly,
not humbly at all.
And defiantly. and commitment to gay Anglicans. And he uses a certain amount in the bishop's statement. They asked, right? Well, actually, instruct us. Don't use that terminology, because one, it's confusing for people who use the term gay in the world. It means something completely different than what you're meaning.
Which, can we just pause there for a second? I think this is like really essential. You're not using the term in your own little theological vacuum. You're using it in a cultural context. Right. You're using it, and if you don't know that you're using it this way, you're deluding yourself, to signal to people in the world who use that word very particularly. It has a particular meaning. You're pretending that it doesn't have that meaning. You're actually, when you invite people into the church and call yourself a gay Christian, and then after a few weeks you explain that being gay and Christian means you can't have sex with anyone,
right?
You're lying to people in the world because they will come in and think, well, no, that the sex part is actually essential to my identity as a gay person.
Yeah.
So
because you tell somebody who in the world says I'm gay, say, oh, that's great, just don't have sex. They'll say, you hater, you're denying myself
my essential nature.
Right.
So no, you can't. One of the reasons not to use the word in the church is because of its precise meaning in the world. And you need to invite people into a more confusing and difficult space wherein they will encounter the idea that their sexuality is something that is not blessed by God, and that's going to be painful and terrible for them. And you shouldn't lie to them right out of the gate. I think that's cruel.
Yeah. Well, and the other reasons were that, you know, you don't find historically communities gathering around a disordered affection. So that, you know, because one of the things that the spiritual friendship movement and other movements point to is monastic communities that form around the desire for prayer and discipline.
Yeah, but it was prayer.
Yeah, they're not. Yes, they were all same sex communities, but they weren't same sex communities because they were all having these struggles with disordered affection.
They came into these communities because they wanted to be free from temptation in the world.
Right.
And of course, I don't know if anybody's read any history, but some of those communities ended up having serious
problems. Yeah, it wasn't great in certain ways.
And a lot of those people should have just gone and gotten married because it wouldn't have been terrible.
Well, obviously things happened.
Women.
Yeah, but obviously it happened. Some homosexual things were taking place in some of these monasteries. And also, if the monasteries were coupled with a nunnery nearby, there were often babies born even that were, it was just crazy. So anyway, not the monastic movement is fine. It's just saying that this
don't
is not
use
that.
That
is this is not that too, though. No, I mean, and then the third reason why is because the gay, you know, identifying with something that God has transformed you out of, or is transforming you out of, is not helpful. It's like, you know, the example I used, and people got mad at me for using it, is, the bestial Christian. You know, if someone is desirous of having sexual relationship with animals but has just committed to celibacy, I think most Christians would say you don't want to call yourself a bestial Christian, because it's you're identifying yourself with such a broken, perverted aspect of your being that it calls into question the power of the gospel.
Yeah.
And people say, well, bestiality is not like homosexuality. Well, yeah, in biblical terms it is. It's right next to, I mean, in Leviticus 18:22 precedes Leviticus 18:23, which deals with bestiality. The two are right next to each other in terms of their the ruination they point to of the human person because of sin. All right, so anyway, he uses the term gay Anglican, thinking that he's getting around the bishop's instruction not to use the term gay Christian,
which
is dishonest. It's fundamentally dishonest. It's kind of like our kids, if you say, you know, you can't say no to us.
Yeah. And then they do. They're like, but.
Yeah, but.
And then, well becomes. And I'm not born yesterday. I understand that you are still having a contrary view to mine, and I told you to do something and you're refusing to do it.
Right. It's a, it's an attempt to circumvent the bishops rather than actually humbly submit to them, which is what this guy says he's doing. So, and with unwavering commitment to the authority, mission, and community of the United States, of the ACNA. No, you're not. If you use that term gay Anglican, you do not have an unwavering commitment to the authority of the ACNA. You just thrown it off, right? Okay, so that's that paragraph kind of sets up our response to that paragraph kind of sets up the rest of the letter, so we don't have to be as slow probably through the whole thing.
I hope not. Dear heaven.
if you're a gay / same sex attracted lifelong Anglican committed to a traditional sexual ethic, a gay agnostic curious about getting to know Jesus as an Anglican in an Anglican context, or anyone in between, this letter is for you.
I would love to say more about biblical sexual ethic, but I'll just let it pass.
Well, we've already said that the biblical sexual ethic is not just remaining celibate. It's also recognizing the need for repentance for disordered desires.
But it's also used, as like this, if I just say this, and if I just tell you that I have a biblical sexual ethic, then you have to believe that I do, and you can't investigate my claim any further,
right?
Because then you're being mean to me. Whereas if you say you have a biblical sexual ethic, that should be examined very closely to see if in fact you have a biblical sexual ethic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you might use the Bible to measure your ethic to see if it's biblical.
Yes. Like instead of just saying that you have it.
All right. So dear gay Anglicans, we affirm what is good and true from the recent pastoral statement on sexual identity from the ACNA bishops, which tells you right away, they don't affirm the statement. They affirm what is true, right?
But they're measuring what's true by their own estimation.
Right. Including its continued commitment to the traditional sexual ethic. There you go. And a recognition that God has made everyone for healthy intimacy in the context of human family.
That's becoming like the Imago Dei. My biblical sexual ethic and my Imago Dei are like my little flags that I wave in the air to say, don't question me. Don't look any further than what I'm saying. Leave me alone. Leave me. Like it's the fake blood that you're painting over the door of your dark heart, hoping that God won't actually look to see if you're a sinner.
Right. So, okay. I mean, it's true that I'm not sure this is right. That God has made everyone for healthy intimacy in the context of the human family. I mean, that was originally true. God did make human beings that way, but now the fall has come. Not everyone has the capacity, and I would say very few people have the capacity to have healthy intimacy in the context of the human family, because our sexual natures, whether we're homosexual, someone sexually inclined or not, they're so broken that there's going to be some disorder in our sexual relationships. So I think this goes to the point that Ashley Noel was making. That even within the heterosexual desire, there's perversions of that, right? There are perversions that you and I need to all of us need to understand and confess and not indulge in, of course, but also recognize that that's broken.
And the problem is it goes so deep that you don't know how broken it is when you start out, you know, so you give your life to the Lord and you start going down the pathway of, you know, the Christian life. And as you go along, you have no idea how deeply disordered you are, how deep your perversions, how much you can't have the thing that you most want, which is a nice human community.
Right.
I mean, you were actually made to glorify God. I mean, you were redeemed. You were made to glorify God, and you were redeemed to glorify God, and you may or may not have really nice human community.
Right.
Like that may not happen for you, but God is still God.
God is still God. Yeah.
So if you don't get that, I'm sorry. Like that's really terrible, but you can still be a human being
in the church.
You can still go to church. Yeah. You can still go to heaven, but like,
I mean, so that well, I think I'm going to hold off for what I was going to say, because he's going to hit on this right now. So let me keep going. So here's the first confession.
Which is actually an accusation.
We confess that while each of our sexualities is broken, churches have often treated different brokenness differently. As provincial statement humbly recognizes, churches have inconsistently applied God's wisdom for sexual stewardship by holding same-sex attracted people to a higher standard than straight people regarding vocational singleness, procreation, divorce, and remarriage. Okay, so first of all, it's fine to treat different brokenness differently because different brokenness is different brokenness. So you don't want to treat all brokenness the same.
Because, it's like I don't actually treat all my children the same because they all have different issues. So I love all of my children, but I don't discipline them all in the same way. I don't demand the same things of them because they all have different, I have to treat all their different brokenness differently.
So for example, if someone comes to me in the church who's struggling with pornography and it's a heterosexual person who's married, the solution to that problem is going to be something like, okay, first of all, let your wife have, or your husband, I'm assuming it was a male, but let your wife or husband have access to all of your devices and all of your passcodes and, you know, try to get some kind of thing like that. But then, you know, what we say, I say typically this, pray that God will direct all of your lust, all of your
desire
toward your wife. And when you feel that desire to go look at porn, go have sex with your wife. And if she won't do it, you need, actually try and get her to understand what's going on so that she'll be more receptive maybe to this.
You really would love to have sex with her because you love her so much and you're so attracted to her. And for the sweet love of God, please have sex with me because we're married and we're supposed to have sex.
Yeah. So
if you refuse to have sex with me over and over again,
I'm really frustrated.
I'm very, very frustrated. Right.
So for that kind of sexual brokenness, we would direct the person to find the appropriate outlet for the sexual release. Now, if someone who has desires for other people of the same sex comes and says, "Hey, I'm watching gay porn,"
and who's not married, you can't say
you got to treat that differently, right? You can't.
This is a different.
You can't say, "Oh, well, why don't you just marry a gay person and then another gay person and then
that person is going to have a painful, radical, like terrible struggle." And so desperately need the grace of God because there isn't going to be an appropriate outlet for that.
Right.
And that is very grievous, of course. No one's saying that it's not hard and difficult and terrible,
but it's not, I guess I wouldn't say that it's more difficult than the single heterosexual person, right?
Who can't look at porn and also can't
have an outlet for the sexual desire.
And what if no one will marry him because he's not marriageable because he's looked at so much porn? Like, you know,
Now, we read this article on Gospel Coalition, right? The women are
increasingly,
the 1 out of 7 people in the generation, whatever, Z, is quote unquote bisexual, and that most women are now looking at lesbian pornography online.
Yeah.
So this is a male and a female thing, but if a person's doing this,
there's no out, like there's, the only remediation is for you to go to church so often and pray so desperately for God to help you and save you that's basically how you should
spend. Right. Right. So I don't agree that the church makes people who have homosexual desire hold to a higher standard. I don't think that's true. I would like to know of the ACNA church that says to people who are having sex outside of marriage in a heterosexual way, "Hey, that's great," or "No worries, don't worry about it," or people who are looking at porn, "Hey, no problem."
Yeah, No one's saying that.
I
haven't seen anyone say that. And as the culture tips further and further into, you know, ruin, I understand it's getting harder and harder for all people who so marry themselves to their various sexual identities. It's really, really hard. Like no one is saying that it's easy.
Right.
And I've appreciated actually in the ACNA how swift and terrible it's been for people who are caught in sexual sin, who are in any kind of authority or in the pastoral ministry. There's not a lot of room, actually. The ACNA is holding everyone to a pretty high standard. It's hard to get remarried. In the ACNA, you don't just get a free pass to divorce and divorce and divorce.
Right.
You don't get a free pass.
We disciplined somebody who divorced without cause recently, a good shepherd. And that's, you know, that's not, we've never disciplined anybody for having homosexual lust issues. We've had people who have homosexual lust issues. And so we're not.
We've even had somebody who had a bestial problem.
Yeah.
And we, by gum, did not bless that person, nor did we treat that person any more differently because of the different brokenness.
Right.
We actually did it. We handled it in exactly the same way that everybody else got their pastoral care, which was appropriate because, I mean, again, the only thing that helps you out of that is the mercy of God.
Right.
But
that's just,
anyway, go on.
So here's the second confession, We confess that many gay Anglicans committed to a traditional sexual ethic have labored faithfully in their sanctification. Well, how is this a confession? Have labored faithfully in their sanctification, but struggle to thrive because our churches have failed to take the practical steps necessary to promote flourishing.
Okay, that's not one of the things that the church is supposed to do, is promote flourishing. The church is supposed to preach and make this and administer the sacraments and bring people to the glory of God and worship and care for the sick. And like, flourishing is not, has never been a good in the Christian life. Like, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I think what, like, originally when the word started being used, it meant something like being further sanctified, but now it's become like, you know, you really identifying with who you are and living yourself out
the church calls people to holiness.
Right.
And the church calls people to die to themselves and take up their crosses and follow Jesus. Show me how that really goes with any of the flourishing language. That's a big deal right now. And I'm sorry, but they're two different, you're saying two different things.
Yeah. And in the words of the provincial statement, many same-sex attracted Christians are fighting the good fight to become more like Jesus, but have, quote, felt ignored by fellow followers of Jesus to the point of feeling invisible. And hey, that's okay. If you feel ignored, I understand. And I'm not so sure though that the feeling is necessarily consistent with reality. I mean, have you told your pastor?
Yeah, because one of the hard things about having a sin like this that goes on and goes really deep is that it's really hard to go to people and get help and sit and be vulnerable and say it out loud. But I'm sorry. I guarantee you, if you walked into any church and you talked to any ACNA pastor and say, I'm really struggling with this, and actually, like, and failing, use the word in its true sense, which means
I'm really failing with this.
Right? I'm failing with this, but please help me. And I feel very alone and sad and isolated. That pastor is not going to say to you,
get out of here, you
horrible gay person. I'm going to make you, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of laws that I haven't given anyone else. That is,
and if he does, that's take it up with a bishop. I mean, that's if any pastor said something like that to you, if you come to him confessing your sins and the pastor just shuts you down and tells you you're wicked and throws you out of his office, that pastor should lose his collar if he's
okay. But that, you know, this is a huge accusation too. Like, this is slanderous.
Yeah.
Show where this has happened in the ACNA. Right. Like, provide some evidence that pastors are going around telling people who are gay or feel like they have same-sex attraction and that they would very much like to act on it, that they are not welcome here and there's no help for them. And no one will invite them over for dinner after church.
Right.
And they are not allowed to go downstairs for coffee. Like, I'm sorry.
That's never happened. I understand why you might feel ignored, but if you're going to make this confession, which sounds more like an accusation, you've got to show where you've been ignored. It's, you know, this is interesting because it goes a lot, it flows in with the kind of woke movement, in which it's all accusation, no, very little evidence, but just the assumption our churches are racist, the system's racist. Let's see some actual concrete examples of this so that we can actually shine the light of,
like, don't measure every last thing by your feelings.
That's
true. Don't measure everything by your feelings. It may be that your feelings, in fact, I would put money down, that your feelings don't represent the totality of reality
right.
that is going on around you. So you need other people around you, of course,
yeah.
to help you. Okay, go on. We're never going to get through this.
Here's another confession. We confess that Christians have perpetuated destructive, reparative conversion therapies, leading many sexual minorities to lose their faith or die by suicide. Even as God possesses the power to heal any brokenness in this world, none of us are promised relief from temptation. I would agree that if there are ministries that say, you know,
pray the gay away.
Yeah, that assume that if you're just doing the right stuff, the temptation is going to go away.
Right.
That's just as warped an understanding of human anthropology as the idea that the disorder can be redeemed. I have heard people say, well, you are not going to be acceptable or say things along the lines of that might make you feel you're not going to be accepted until you become heterosexual in your desires. And that may not happen. I mean, there are temptations that every single one of us are going to struggle with and fall to the rest of our lives, because God in his graciousness and his goodness doesn't want us to grow proud. And so sometimes he lets us be weak and fall, and we have to then confess and be humble ourselves. So I can hear this. However, I would want to say there are people who do want to try and change their, do want to have their desires transformed. I don't think they should be pressured from the outside to be perfect in this way. Or to have their, anyways, it's an act of God's grace, but if people want to pursue that, there should be options available for them.
Also, I'd like to know the number of people who have committed suicide in
because
the ACNA
of that, right?
because of this, because
right.
of reparative therapy. Like that, again, huge accusation, nothing to
back it up.
Well,
it does say Christians, not Anglicans, but
but still, like, I think that number has been way overblown.
And I'd like, why bring it up here in a letter addressed to Anglicans?
Yeah. So,
is there any evidence that Anglicans have done this?
Like, I've been in Anglican my entire life, and I've never heard any Anglicans be like, hey guys, let's go big in for the reparative therapy. Like, Anglicans are very like, oh, I'm so sorry that you have that going on. Can I get you another glass of sherry? Like, you do you. Like, that's one
right.
maybe fault of Anglicans, is that we are very careful not to intrude on people's personal lives,
right.
which maybe helps with the feeling of isolation, but like,
right.
you can't have it both ways.
So I'm going to skip most of the next paragraph because it's just got offering stats about research has demonstrated that these therapies have been 96% ineffective at eliminating same-sex attraction while increasing the risk of suicide attempts by 92%. So again, it's fine, but show us where this is happening in the ACNA. Instead, we commend churches who offer pastoral care that strengthens any Christian's spiritual health and capacity to resist temptation, knowing that the already not yet nature of our salvation means that many will manage enduring temptations for a lifetime. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, I don't know that there's any, I would like some evidence of a church that's not offering pastoral care to strengthen every Christian's spiritual health and capacity to resist temptation.
I can tell you the problem with that is that people don't avail themselves of what the church already offers all the time. The church offers so much to help people struggle against temptation, but most people are like, actually, I'm good. I don't need to come to church every Sunday. I don't need to go to morning prayer. I don't need to read my Bible. I don't need to pray. I don't need pastoral care. I don't need to talk to my pastor. I'm good now. I need nothing. I will just suffer in isolation in my house.
And then I'll talk about how the church is ignoring me.
Yeah. And so, you know what? That path is available to every single Christian, even and especially during COVID. So the community that feels that it's been singled out for particular sorrow should open their eyes, because everyone does the I won't get help option.
Okay, so we recognize the various arguments for and against using the phrases same-sex attraction and gay Christian. In the words of the provincial statement, neither of the identifying phrases is ideal, universally understood, or free of baggage. While spirit-filled Christians disagree about the wisest language for sexual minorities to use to describe themselves, we echo the provincial statement's, quote, respect for those within our ACNA family who may disagree with our conclusions, yet remain true to the biblical witness. Okay, now they're really picking and choosing here through the statement, because the statement is very clear about the instruction that it gave regarding not using this language. But this paragraph is dishonest in the sense that it makes it sound like the statement was totally open to people completely and flatly violating the instruction. And that's not what was said. In fact, the Archbishop's letter in response to this flatly denied that. So now, secondly, notice that language, sexual minority.
Yeah, no.
No.
Nope.
Unless we're willing to also have these, I don't think we're willing to, so this is a rhetorical thing here, unless we're willing to have the bestial community or the pedophilia community or the pornographic community or the whatever community, we don't have sexual minority groups like this in the church. We don't form minority groups around our sexual perversions, our sexual disorders. That's precisely what the church is trying to fight, what the ACNA statement sought to undermine.
Yeah.
So notice that, and that enables then, you know, that enable, you might recognize that the overall tone of this message is one of an aggrieved minority that feels, that is expressing a kind of victim status.
Mm-hmm.
We've been oppressed. And there are certainly ethnic minority groups that have been oppressed and that suffer kind of either racial or ethnic offenses against them, but there is no such thing as a sexual minority in the church.
I agree with you. I'm trying to let you get through the letter.
Okay, all right.
I'm not like
I know. We probably lost our listener by now.
Well, so, because this is in every single portion of the culture, like. This is helpful because this is coming to your local church and this has come to every corner of your, you know, internet feed. And so I know, like, let the Anglican world be as a warning to others. We keep doing this, but, mm-hmm. You know, in this case, it's not the long defeat for us anymore. We had the long defeat in tech and now I'm excited for the quick, short,
yeah.
No, you can't do that.
Yeah. No, that's one of the great victories coming out of this, is there was a quick, you can't do that from our archbishop, and his bishop, Bishop Minns, came up and said, no, you can't
do that.
That's why you can only find this letter now in Anglican Inc, because the bishop stopped him. So there are some really good things about the response. However, you know, this is as the rest of the letter indicates, this, Peter Valk considers himself the leader of a movement, and he is not going to give up. He is going to push this thing. He indicated that he was going to push this thing in several comments he made on Facebook, which I posted on my Facebook page. So he is not repentant. He's not in any way pulling back. And he needs to be opposed, as do those who support him. And also, and I think Mark Marshall pointed this out, that of Stand Firm, that this is part of a larger thing. This is part of the woke movement. And so what I think I would encourage, I know we have lots of bishops listening to this.
Is our listener a bishop?
I would encourage our bishops.
Sure, that's not true.
To release a statement, the statement maybe that the committee put together on race and racial relations, because that also takes a pretty firm stand against some of the, problems that arise from
it's a nexus, it's a cluster, right, of issues and ways of thinking that are not Christian, that are really contrary to all Christian thought, and Christians should be warned away from them and not get caught in the trap of thinking that they're special or a victim or anything like that.
Right. So let me just, I can probably read this all in like one shot here.
Okay, read it and then we can.
So we commit to supporting gay, same-sex attracted Anglicans as they discern before God in Scripture and with trusted friends and family the best ways to testify faithfully to God's goodness in that part of their story. Nor do either of these phrases affect our identity in Christ. As the ACNA Catechism states, faith in Christ, signaled by baptism, is all that is required to be securely in Christ and to have one's identity in Christ. We commit to take practical steps to become churches where gay Anglicans can share all of their story, find community, and seek support. We affirm the provincial statement's call to lead conversation about God's love and wisdom for same-sex attracted people across the lifespan, so children and teenagers feel safe to share early with parents and pastors. We commit to take practical steps to train pastors to provide compassionate and effective pastoral care to same-sex attracted people as called for by the provisional statement. We commit to provide the teaching and practical support gay Anglicans in vocational singleness or mixed orientation marriage need to thrive in their vocations with reasonable effort. We commit to develop and deliver the practical resources necessary to equip parents and pastors to extend Christ's love to sexual minorities. We pray God would give us the courage to fulfill these commitments so that gay Anglicans thrive according to God's wisdom in our churches and lead us with their preaching, prayer, and song. So again, this is a movement.
I'm particularly disturbed by the idea that they would focus in on the young and the youth, if the parents and the pastoral care that exists in churches already are not able and equipped to do a good job of that, which they are actually. Churches are called to catechize and bring young people along. And I'm sorry, but a thing that's very problematical, scare quotes, and disordered is not the kind of group or people that you invite in to have anything to do with your youth and your children and your children's ministry, unless you want to end up with big, big, big problems later.
Right.
And it's excessively naive to think that a group that is entrenching itself as aggrieved and offended would need to be anywhere near any discipleship structures in any church inside of the ACNA. So, part is really very troubling to me.
Some of the messaging coming to our children from the world is your sexuality is fluid. You can decide to be a girl. You can decide to be a boy. You just need to look inside yourself and decide what you are. And I think that's why you have in the younger generation, 1 out of 7 people deciding they're bisexual, because our culture pushes that. So the last thing we need is people coming into our churches and saying, hey, you know, do you like boys? Or if you're a boy, do you like girls? That's cool. You know, that means you need to identify as a gay Anglican.
You can never act on it, and it's going to be really tough for you.
Right.
But here's a special community where you're going to, in your isolation, feel you don't need the ordinary means of grace inside of a community of faithful people. Your family doesn't understand you. Nobody understands you. You're very, very special and precious. And here we are to help you. I'm sorry. I think it's naive and it's dangerous and no.
I totally understand, you know, maybe when you're about 10, 15, or 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, you might, as you're developing sexually, you might find yourself unattracted to the opposite sex and attracted to the same sex. And that is something that you should be willing, and I agree, the churches should be willing to hear people say that at that age. You don't want to have that kind of struggle going on secretly.
I guess,
so,
you know, like in all of this, I'm, you need the pastor of a church in any denomination, like you don't really need a parachurch, whatever, from the outside coming in and saying, that yeah. That they're going to disciple yeah. your people for
the last year. Yeah, you
like people inside of the church need to listen to the preaching of the preacher, and they need to trust the pastor, which means they need to open up to him.
Right.
They need to go to him to confess their sins. They need to ask for pastoral help. They need to go to the structures that the local churches put in place in order to take care of their people, to tend the flock of right. God. And so
I was
the church is like able to do yeah. that. That's what it's for. That's what Jesus, it's not flourishing. It's being in the wilderness and being taken care of by God and right. giving what you need, water and food, spiritual care, in the difficulties and trials of your life. And the local church is the place where you do that.
Right.
And you don't need Peter Valk or, you need the hierarchical structures of the church in order to do that. But if you don't open yourself up to that and you decide that you're going to go online and find some other group that's going to really help you, you're endangering your soul. You need to not do that.
I was just going to say how thankful I was at Good Shepherd. Several people have approached me on this question with sexual longings that were for other people of the same sex. And I felt happy about that because, we have been on the forefront of the fight about sexuality. So, one of my worries was that maybe I've been so strong about the heresy of same-sex marriage or same-sex relationships within the church that people wouldn't feel comfortable coming to me. But, thanks be to God that people did have shared with me their temptations and their failures about that. So all that to say, no matter how strong your pastor seems about the question with regard to the heresy out there,
well, because he's so strong,
you might,
it means that he cares about
right,
you.
Right, exactly.
He really loves right, you. He right. really wants to help you. He has practical help for you. If he is standing in the pulpit and saying, this is not okay. If you're sitting in the pew and you're committing adultery and the pastor stands up on Sunday morning and says, if you're committing adultery, you're binding your soul to hell, then you should hear what he says and go to him, because he, when he finds out what you're doing, will not say to you, go to hell. He will say, oh my word, let me help you. Come right. stay on my couch. Like,
right.
I'll do anything to help you.
Right.
And one of the things that he's doing is warning you off of sin. You don't yeah. know yourself, but the scripture knows you and God knows you. So trust what God has already given you, because he loves you and he wants to save you from your sins and from yourself.
We've gone over an hour.
Okay. So, and on this that
longest,
note,
this is the longest one we've done in a long time. So the other one cut off last week, we cut off too early because of our
dog.
Technological inconsistent. Yeah. Yeah. The dog knocked the Come microphone in. Or something.
So anyway, I really hope that we end up talking about something else next week, but
yeah.
thank you for persisting and,
Nevertheless,
they persisted. Yet again, here we are again. Then, it's still Lent, so we're persisting. Okay, so thank you for listening, and maybe we'll be back next week.